And I'm going to let Elaine properly introduce Dr. Thomas Van Planner.
Tom Van Planner and I met a couple of years ago at a cataclysmic conference in Portland, Oregon. And I had known of him through Richard, and I was very impressed, and I was very privileged and pleased to meet him and to have a conversation with him, and then more so to invite him to come to this conference to share the podium with these two other distinguished guests. Tom Van Planner has written Dark Matter, Missing Planets, and New Comets, a book that describes very skillfully some of the anomalous astronomy. Tom has spent 20 years with the U.S. Naval Observatory, Chief of Celestial Mechanics. And when he left there in 1991, he formed his own company called Meta Research, which is devoted to anomalous astronomy. So he takes a lot of the views of common astronomy and really questions it. You see, he's using his critical mind. And this is the kind of thing I really would like to see more of us develop, because he's challenging some of the mainstream modalities that we have been taught over the years repeatedly, which now he says are not true, such as the Big Bang. He said that didn't happen, and there's no such thing as an Oort cloud. And there's a whole two pages of anomalies in his book that I was very impressed in reading. He's been a research associate at the University of Maryland Physics Department, improving on the accuracy of the global positioning system. He's been a consultant to NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. He does gravity, or he did receive a prize from the Gravity Research Foundation. He's had various instructional positions and has appeared several times on PBS Project Universe. He, through his meticulous research, depended upon his own visual analysis. You see, you know, if you don't see it, it's not there, right? But if it is there, then you have to question what's it all about. And that's what Tom does. He's best known in astronomical circles for his exploded planet theory, and he challenges the conventional astronomy, as we have discussed. Today he will reveal more of that to you. So join me in welcoming Tom Van Planner.
Thank you, and good afternoon. Okay, can I be heard throughout the room? Okay, thank you. Today I'd like to tell you the first part of the story. This will be dealing with the exploded planet hypothesis, an apparently important factor in the evolution of our solar system and probably of all planetary systems. The talk might equally well have been titled The Exploded Planet Hypothesis and the Possibilities for Life in Our Solar System. We'll see how that situation evolves, and then tomorrow we'll be applying some of this information and talking more specifically about the Cydonia region and how it ties into the exploded planet hypothesis, how it ties in with geological history of the Earth, and how the builders of the artifacts there may have some unexpected relationships to us just discovering this information today. Before beginning the discussion of the exploded planet hypothesis, there was one other development which didn't quite fit into the topic, but which I wanted to share with you today. So I have one slide dealing with another possibility, another interesting topic. the speed of gravity. This, of course, relates to the origin of the universe, the nature of things, and specifically the nature of gravity. And I just wanted to mention this because even though its connection, there is some, but its connection is remote, there is a new development on this. Now, in my book, Dark Matter, Missing Planets, and New Comets, you'll see presented there a modern version of the old Lesage theory that gravity can be very easily explained by a little sea of corpuscles in space. This gives rise to the inverse square force, the attraction between all masses, and it gives rise to some interesting new properties of gravity as well, not all of which are presently known or recognized by physics. And one of them is that the little corpuscles must fly around much faster than light. And I pointed out in the book that there were lots of lines of evidence to the fact that gravity did in fact propagate faster than light. This is a no-no for physicists because the theory of relativity has as a corollary that nothing can go faster than light. I've been insisting for some time in both my book and in more technical articles that there is an easy explanation showing why that proof, quote in quote marks, in special relativity is not applicable to modern experiments, and that there's a simple way around that limitation, and that gravity is an existing example, and that we have lots of experimental evidence. I was finally challenged by an editor to put it in proper technical form, and he assured me of a fair review process. Basically, the results that I put in technical form were that the speed of gravity from direct experimental measurements is not less than 20 billion times faster than the speed of light. It is almost certainly not instantaneous. Although if the Big Bang universe is all there is, this would be a very surprising speed. But in an infinite universe, this is a fairly piddling speed. And that this rapid speed of propagation of gravity leads to some very interesting and, by the way, very favorable consequences in both quantum physics and cosmology, doing away with an awful lot of the paradoxes that the professionals are struggling with in current days. And now I get to the part that's really incredible. A major international physics journal has accepted the paper after peer review for publication. And I'll begin the story of the exploded planet hypothesis more or less at the beginning of the solar system. The current paradigm for how planets form is that there is a large cloud of gas and dust, and it, due to some instability, perhaps caused by distant supernova, it gets stirred up and denser regions begin to collapse. And the more they collapse, the more they drag in the rest of the cloud, and the whole process begins to collapse and form masses. Now, this is probably not far from the truth in the case of forming stars, but the process is of such a nature that you probably only form objects as big as stars, and it's very unlikely that you would be able to get small masses out of this because of problems with angular momentum and cohesion, and there are many things we're trying to explain today using this model that just so far have defied explanation, such as the tendency of most of the planets to have prograde spin. That does not come from the solar nebula model, and it's considered a mystery in that model, and a variety of other anomalies. But this competes with another theory that was on the table long ago in astronomy, but as is prone to happen when two theories compete with one another, a champion comes along for one of them, and the champion gathers a lot of data and a lot of followers, and pretty soon his prestige is invested in one of the models and that of his followers, and he writes books and teaches courses and gets funding, and a bandwagon develops, and pretty soon everyone is pushing that model at the expense of the other. And we've had that happen time and time again, not just in astronomy, but throughout science. It's, I think, largely the reason we have the Big Bang Theory today. Despite the, failure of it to be supported by any good, sound observational fact, everything has to be adjusted after it's discovered using adjustable parameters in the theory. Its predictability has been essentially zilch, and that includes the cosmic microwave background radiation, the one that's usually credited to the Big Bang as being a successful prediction. If you look at the historical record, it was far from being a successful prediction. The correct prediction of the background and its temperature, the only correct prediction of its temperature, being done by Sir Arthur Eddington in 1926 using a non-Big Bang model. So as this gets us back to the beginning of the solar system, let's see, I'll keep track of time here. The model that was left on the table by Laplace's solar nebula hypothesis was the fission model, the idea that once you had a huge cloud of gas and dust, it would form into a protostar that included much of the cloud that would all then start rotating with the star. And as things collapsed, things would rotate faster and faster. And like a skater with her arms extended, if she pulls her arms in, she'll spin up faster. As the solar system contracts, it would spin faster. And during this process of contracting and spinning up, it would several times reach the stage where the spin was so rapid that that the centrifugal force of the outer parts would be stronger than the binding forces of gravity, and the result would be that you would spin off large masses. And this was a model for how the planets originally formed. It's called the fission hypothesis. And it has the advantage that it does account for the angular momentum of the solar system. It does account for the prograde preference of the spin of the planets and a number of other anomalies. But what I've noticed in recent years that it does a lot more than that. It is much more specific in predicting the solar system that through independent lines of evidence of considering the exploded planet hypothesis I'd come to suspect was a better description of the original solar system than the one we have in our textbooks today. We're used to the idea of nine planets of the sun. But I think that a good case can be made, and I'll make some of these points today, that the original solar system consisted of only six of the planets that we still have around, plus a number of other objects that are no longer still around. I think Venus and Earth were original planets, but Mercury is almost certainly an escaped moon of Venus, very analogous to Earth's single moon. I think that Jupiter and Saturn were original planets, that Uranus and Neptune were original planets. Pluto is almost certainly an escaped satellite of Neptune. And Pluto and its moon Charon are probably both escape moons of Neptune, because there's plenty of evidence for the disruption of the Neptune system. And for reasons I'll come to later in this talk and be more specific about, I think that Mars, which also is in the mass range of Mercury and Pluto, is also an escape moon of a planet that is no longer there. So taking away the three small guys, really small guys, Mars, Mercury, and Pluto, none of which is any bigger than a tenth of the Earth's mass, that leaves the six large guys, And what do we notice about them? They tend to come in twin pairs. Venus and Earth are very much have many similarities, especially in size and mass. And of course, they're adjacent to one another in distance from the Sun. Likewise, Jupiter and Saturn are the twin giants, and Uranus and Neptune are even more similar to each other than any of the others. It appears that the missing planets may also have occurred in twin pairs, and I'll mention a couple of examples of that. But in the vision model, there is a prediction that, let me just do a brief rearrangement here. Sometimes parallax keeps me from easily seeing the screen to my right. So in the fission model, planets would form through this process a periodic overspinning as the solar nebula collapses. Every time it spins off masses in the form of planets, then there is a further contraction and relaxation of the spin. But as contraction process and the collapse continues, you then build up more spin and you eventually have another overspin and you shed more planets further in. So in this model, the planets are formed from the outermost first to the innermost last, and not simultaneously. But also, this works well for forming the moons of the planets through the same process. The planets themselves are now large clouds of collapsing protosolar material that in turn spin up as they collapse, and they spin off further satellites in a second order process. And so this provides a natural mechanism for both the formation of planets and for the formation of planetary satellites. With the interesting wrinkles that in the fission process, if you have a solid planet, you will tend to break off one piece at the weakest point as the object overspins, and that will tend to immediately relax the rest of the mass from the stresses of overspinning after you've ejected just one mass. So you tend to form singlet moons, whereas if you have a liquid or gaseous star or planet that reaches overspin, the overspin produces bulges on both sides. And as one side breaks off, it will the relaxation will tend to snap off the other side as well, since there's no structural strength to a liquid or gaseous body. And so you will always form twin pairs through that process. Not identical, but reasonably similar pairs, depending upon the spin and mass conditions of the collapsing parent. So this is a specific prediction of the model, and it is an observation certainly for the original major planets and apparently for their satellites, their moons as well, as I'll remark in a moment. After they initially come off, then tidal forces do the evolution of the orbits from there and tend to lock the satellites to their primaries through tidal forces so that the spins match the orbital periods. In the case of the true original planets, the ones that are not escape moons, they tend to occur in twin pairs, and the because tidal forces, in the case of a protostar, which would have a slowly rotating core and rapidly rotating exterior, tidal forces are such that the larger of the two twin pairs will orbit above outward faster and be the outermost of the two. That's a necessary condition for that. I'll come back to the one obvious exception in a moment. However, in the case of forming moons, the collapse of the planets being primarily a thermal collapse results in the the opposite angular momentum arrangement and the opposite, therefore, evolution by tides, so that the more massive of the two twin pairs will always be the innermost of the two in the orbits that evolve through tidal friction. So how does this compare with actual data? Well, in the case of planets, Earth is slightly more massive than Venus, that works, and Neptune is slightly more massive than Uranus, that works. But Jupiter is a lot more massive than Saturn, so much so that it doesn't even look like a twin when it comes to mass. And we'll see in a moment that I suspect that that is because Jupiter's mass has been heavily modified by what's missing from the solar system. Some of those missing planets, I think, are the victims of explosions. They were there in the original solar system and are there no longer. And Jupiter is the giant vacuum cleaner of the solar, excuse me, of our solar system. And it tends to absorb any objects that wind up strewn about the solar system that cross Jupiter's orbit in any direction, in any plane. Jupiter will eventually either eject them from the solar system or accrete them into itself. So the result is, I think that Jupiter's mass has been heavily modified from the early solar system by the absorption of probably the bulk of the mass of four exploded planets. Two of those are in the main asteroid belt, excuse me, today. One of them would probably be what right in the center of the present asteroid belt, the belt of tens of thousands of asteroids, where most of them are of the C or carbonaceous type when we look at their spectra. And I think that the parent body of that was the larger of a pair of twin planets. And Michael Ovenden, the Canadian dynamical astronomer in the 1970s, who also discovered a lot of evidence for the former existence of this planet, wanted to name it Krypton after Superman's home planet. I think that's a fine suggestion, but being less ambitious and not wanting to appear to be too whimsical, I shortened that to Planet K for Krypton after the suggestion of using single letters to designate unknown planets, such as Planet X, where that was the hypothetical planet beyond Neptune that has yet to be discovered. X stood for the unknown and also for 10th planet. Well, that was what I thought we were talking about originally when I found also evidence for the exploded planet hypothesis. But I've since come to learn that the evidence is a good deal more complex than that, and one exploded planet won't do it. And even in the main asteroid belt, there are actually two rather distinct classes of asteroids. There are the C types, which are 80% of the asteroids and dominate the main asteroid belt. And then there are S types, which are spectrally rather different. And there's sort of a distinctive, there's some overlap, but there's a fairly distinctive partition into two classes, each with a separate peak in the number distribution. And it seems clear that there are two parent bodies to the main population, each a bit different in chemical composition. Well, where was the second planet to be? Bode's law didn't leave room for another planet. And then I realized that Mars, of course, was too small to be an original planet, and that more likely it was a moon of this planet. In the orbit it now occupies, that it was originally the orbit of what I originally thought was the original fifth planet, so I named it Planet V for the Roman numeral for five. I now regret that choice because the numbering has gotten considerably more complex. Oh, thank you. The numbering no longer works out to be five anymore, but I don't want to keep changing nomenclature, so I continue to call it Planet V. So V and K are the hypothetical original parent planets of the asteroids V in the present orbit of Mars, with Mars as one of its moons, and K in the main part of the asteroid belt. I don't expect the figures in the slide to be legible from the back of the room, but I'm giving you the essence of the material that's summarized in the slides. As far as the outer solar system goes, we probably have, again, a situation where, interestingly, the same mass range, you go from Venus and Earth up in mass through V and K, Jupiter and Saturn are sort of the peak of the mass range in the solar system. Uranus and Neptune are much smaller in mass, and anything beyond that would have to be smaller yet. Going through that same critical mass range, we again seem to have objects that probably are remnants of former planets, and there may be something about that mass range which is especially unstable and shortens the life expectancy of planets. But in the last 4 years, five years now, we have discovered that there is another asteroid belt out there beyond Neptune. It's often called the Kuiper Belt, and referred to as a comet belt, but there isn't a shred of evidence that any of these objects are cometary in any way at all. There is just plain no similarity between them and comets. It's just that there was a theory predicting that you needed a source for comets out there to help with the standard model. So when some asteroids were discovered out there, immediately everybody said, ah, at last we found the Kuiper Belt and we know where our reservoir of comets is. That again is something that has not gone along with the more recent discoveries. The more we learn about the nature of these objects, the less they seem like any sort of comet that's ever been found before. They're unusually red objects. They do occupy the next band out to where a planet might be beyond Neptune. They have about the same general character as objects in the main asteroid belt. And the most recent discovery is we found just one, but from the improbability of finding even one in the very limited searching that was done. In other words, it was either an amazing case of serendipity or it's just a prototype of many more to be found. There is one object in even the next band beyond that, much further out, about 60 to 80 astronomical units. And it was already suggested, even by the mainstream astronomers who found it, that it probably represents another band of asteroids beyond the one that's just beyond Neptune. So even though there's only one member of the second group, there is reason to suspect, even by mainstream astronomers, that there are two more belts of asteroids out there. And this again goes along with the idea of planets are in twin pairs. And one of them having been designated X, I'm wondering then if the hypothetical planet X might be in the form of asteroids having exploded rather than as a whole planet. These days, I'm not concluding that necessarily there is no planet still to be discovered out there, but I'm considering the possibility that the former planet that we've been searching for some time may now be an exploded planet, or there may still be a planet yet beyond the outermost asteroid belt in the stable mass range again, similar to Earth in size. That would be the planet X that we've been looking for. But I've named the other two X and T, T for trans-Neptunian. And those, I suggest, are hypothetical original planets of the solar system. That brings us to 10. And I would suggest that probably there are two more. I make that suggestion because if we do the Titius-Bode law of planetary spacing properly, in the original solar system, it would be not the distance ratio that Titius and Bode found, but rather there would be a ratio of periods of 2 to 1 exactly, if the solar system had never been disturbed from its original condition. And when we do it that way, there is room for two more planets in the sequence. And that's the minor reason for suspecting two more. The major reason is because Astronomers have been trying to explain for some time what on Earth happened in the very early solar system to explain what has been dubbed by the mainstream astronomers the late heavy bombardment. Let me just read a couple of quotes to you from the encyclopedia, from a review article summarizing what the late heavy bombardment, what it is that we know of it. I missed one slide. To complete the story on the fission model, I didn't mention how the moons line up with the thought that they should also form in twin pairs. When we examine the moons, looking at Jupiter's large, Venus and Earth would have singlet moons, Venus's being Mercury, before its escape. Jupiter has four large original moons, and Io and Europa are relative twins in terms of mass, with the Io the more massive being the inner of the two. Ganymede and Callisto are relative twins, with the more massive being the inner of the two. Titan is the only large remaining moon of Saturn, but there's a large gap in the orbit plane next to Titan where apparently a moon is missing. And the other moons are much too small to be original moons. They're more like remnants of an object that broke up. At Uranus, we have four moons again. Aerial and Umbriel are twin pairs, with the more massive being the inner. And Titania and Oberon are twin pairs, with the more massive being the inner. So just the reverse of the planet situation, they do also come in twin pairs, but whereas with the planets, the more massive is the outer, with the moons, the more massive is the inner. When we get to Neptune, the whole satellite system has been heavily disrupted, probably by a close approach from one of the planets beyond. But if we consider that both Pluto and Triton were former moons of Neptune, they would make excellent twin pairs, with almost certainly Triton the innermost of the two, and the outermost being the one that as well. And this model would predict that Charon would be another member of a twin pair, and that we're in the process of discovering these trans-Neptunian asteroids. Prediction is that we will find the twin of Charon orbiting out there as well. So this prediction works very well throughout the solar system, and this is a fairly new result. Now to the late heavy bombardment. I don't expect, this is the smallest print on any of the slides. I'm just going to read these quotes. I don't expect them to be readable beyond the front row of the audience if they're. But this is a description of what astronomers know about this part of the solar system's history. I'll read these descriptions, which the astronomers consider to be a puzzle, and think of an exploding planet hypothesis in the back of your mind, which the astronomers don't do, as I'm reading these. From the review paper, a flux of impactors flooded the terrestrial planet's region and is preserved in the cratering record of the heavily cratered terrain on each planet, and one might add each moon's each planetary moon whose surface can retain cratering record. These are giant impacts, the basins on our moon, the basins on Mercury, the very heavy cratering seen on Mars and the Galilean moons, and so on. An essential requirement of any explanation for the great heavy bombardment is that the impactors be stored somewhere in the solar system until they are suddenly unleashed about 4.0 billion years ago. Again, these are quotes by mainstream astronomers who are not thinking in terms of exploding planets, but trying to think in terms of some kind of cataclysm that suddenly unleashed a lot of impactors and produced this heavy bombardment on all the surfaces. Another quote is, it may have been preceded by several other bombardments which were not easily discernible in the cratering record. I would predict, based on this model, that specifically there were two original planets, the twin pairs that exploded probably something of the order of a few hundred million years apart and produced everything that we see and call the Great Heavy Bombardment. The last quote is, a plausible explanation for the late heavy bombardment remains something of a mystery. So that's why I suggest that two other planets I've called A and B are part of the original inventory, and that the solar system originally probably condensed with 12 planets, of which six remain. So if that conjecture is correct, it may be that explosion is a natural end state for all planets, as it seems to be for most stars. Fortunately, however, the time scales for these are billions of years, and therefore this is not implying any kind of imminent threat to be concerned about for Earth. Now, this is an artist concept of a planet from a solar system, from a planetary system well beyond Earth. In this case, the artist picked 51 Pegasi, one of the first planets, first stars to be confirmed to have a planet orbiting it in the recent rash of such findings. The fission model predicts that this is a natural mechanism for the formation of planets around stars of a certain type all through the galaxy, and that therefore all of these stars ought to be forming their planets in twin pairs too. Now, before this rash of new discoveries came out, I made a specific prediction based on the fission model. I said that when planets around other stars are found, most of them will be found in twin pairs. But I said in the early days, the twin pairs will be in normal 2-to-1 period relationships to each other. And you won't notice in the early data, because of the period resonance, that there are two planets there. What instead you'll see is an up and down cycle looking like one planet that's modulated by the other planet, and it will look to the astronomers as though you have one planet with a highly eccentric orbit. And then only after many years, when you get enough of these cycles, will you be able to separate them and see that there are actually two separate planets there in circular orbits. So the prediction was that, yes, the planets will be found in twin pairs, but in the early findings, you'll find planets that appear to be in eccentric orbits, which was a quite unexpected prediction because all the astronomers and using solar nebula type models were expecting planets in circular orbits, near circular, just more or less like our own solar system. Well, one of the course, the early findings of the now building inventory of such planets, I think we're at somewhere in the 12 to 15 range, I've lost count, is that half or more of them seem to be on highly eccentric orbits, and this is a big mystery and a big puzzle to the mainstream astronomers. I think that not only was I not surprised by that orbit, I think that they're in for another surprise as the observations accumulate and we get a little more time and radial velocity resolution on these objects. I think that the next announcement you'll see probably in the 5 to 10 year time scale is that first one and then several of these with eccentric orbits are going to turn out to be two planets in circular orbits. Well, that leads us directly to the modern day, that is, last 100 million year evidence for the exploded planet hypothesis. And I'd like to pay particular attention to this relatively recent history of the solar system, because I think this is the period during which life, intelligent life, existed. In some places in our solar system. I think that the that planet V, the hypothetical parent planet of Mars, is an especially likely candidate for life to have evolved, and may possibly be the first place in the solar system that intelligent life evolved. But first, the exploded planet hypothesis itself. What are some of the lines of evidence that lead us to suspect this? Here I'm just going to mention a few sample points. In chapter 11 of my book, Dark Matter, Missing Planets and New Comets, there is a synthesis of all the evidence I'd collected as of 1993. There are about 100 and some odd lines of evidence which are explicated, and their interpretation in terms of the exploded planet hypothesis or conventional models are compared. And what one can see at a glance, and what tends to make this so compelling to me, is not so much that you can't explain any one fact either way, as that with the exploding planet hypothesis, one hypothesis with no need for adjustable parameters kind of does it all. That gives you everything you see about the solar system that's otherwise unexplained, whereas in the conventional models you need a separate theory for the origin and evolution of comets, the so-called Oort cloud theory, and a separate theory for the origin and evolution of asteroids and the dual nature of the asteroid belts, and separate theories for origin and evolution of meteoroids and meteorites and all their classes and why they have age ranges so different, and so on. And within comets there are sub-theories. You have models of why comets split, another theory with its adjustable parameters, and the dirty snowball theory, and on. So you wind up with literally about a dozen major theories and countless sub-theories needed to explain all the same evidence. There's something we were taught long ago in science called Occam's Razor, and it's supposed to mean that you don't invent unnecessary hypotheses. If you have one hypothesis that doesn't violate any laws of physics and explains everything you see, then you prefer that one over the explanation that requires two or more hypotheses. And that seems to be the thing I think that one of the places where I tend to depart from my mainstream colleagues. The momentum behind the conventional model seems to be mainly one of historical evolution, learning a particular way and not wanting to change, more than it is going with the trend of all the observational data of late. So let's look at a few of these points. In the asteroid belt, the relative velocities among asteroids are much larger than the relative velocities among asteroids in the asteroid belt are as large as they can be for stable orbits in that part of the solar system. The mean velocity between any two asteroids that's selected at random is 5 kilometers per second, and 7 kilometers per second would be such that the orbits would escape completely from that region of the solar system. They would wind up Jupiter crossing and would be ejected or from the solar system or absorbed by Jupiter. So that's as large a root mean square velocity as you can have and still have stable orbits. Whereas in all other cases where you condense a lot of small particles and they form into rings, the mean root mean velocities damp out and you have essentially no relative velocity between the particles, as in the stable rings such as those of Saturn. So this is, again, is an indication of a very energetic event involved in their formation. Explosion signatures, what that means is the orbital elements, the catalogs of the orbits of the asteroids, they're not random at all, but they have certain patterns among them. Astronomers didn't even know about some of the patterns until the exploded planet hypothesis directed our attention to them. The ones they did know about They simply catalog them without explanation as interesting features of the asteroid belt. Then we had some rockets in Earth orbit launched by man that exploded while in orbit. And we tracked the fragments, and two dynamicists, Gabbard and Wackernagel in the 60s, they noticed that patterns occurred in the elements of the fragments that it were in Earth orbit as a result of the explosion, and that the patterns were caused by the fact that all of the orbits at one time had a common point in both space and time. So basically all the orbits intersected and then precessed so that they no longer intersected, but that still left patterns in the orbital elements. And they cataloged these patterns, and they turned out to be identical to the same kind of patterns that are found in the main asteroid belt. They called them explosion signatures before they knew about the similarity with the main asteroid belt. So these are found there, and again are an indication of an explosion origin rather than a more conventional origin. When it comes to meteorites on Earth, we have presumably samples of asteroids and comets, and one of the mysteries about them is that they have very young exposure ages. That is, the time they've been floating around in space is not that long, typically millions of years, not billions. And so that led to yet another sub-theory on the main theory. Well, they couldn't any of them be original objects. They have to be broken off pieces from larger parent bodies that are so fragile that from constant bombardment by little meteorites every few million years, they're breaking up again, exposing fragments freshly from their interior that resets the slate for exposure ages to cosmic rays. So that's the conventional explanation of why the exposure to cosmic rays gives such young ages. In the exploded planet hypothesis, there were several explosion events. I'll be more specific in a moment, but the most recent of those was apparently just 3.2 million years ago. And the most recent large explosion was 65 million years ago. And this accounts directly for the young exposure ages and for the clustering around those dates. The exploded planet hypothesis predicted that a significant fraction of asteroids of a certain type and all comets came from a comet origin from the most recent explosion event. So that predicted that comets and asteroids would be basically the same type of body, and that they would have strong similarities. Astronomers had comets being dirty snowballs and originating in the outer solar system, and asteroids being rocks originating closer to the sun, and expected few, if any, similarities between these two, and have been increasingly frustrated as first the spectra and the albedos and the chemical types and the size ranges and all of the various properties that we can measure have been so nearly identical that no one characteristic clearly distinguishes a comet from an asteroid. So they were reduced to the bare characteristics that, well, comets have tails and comas and asteroids don't. Of course, the exploded planet hypothesis says that's simply because if a comet stays close enough to the sun eventually boils off all the volatiles and it loses its coma and its tail, and it looks like an asteroid exactly. Just in the last 2 years, astronomers have discovered a comet that looked exactly like an asteroid but had a comet-like orbit because it went way into the outer solar system, and they discovered a catalog asteroid that had suddenly developed a coma and a tail. So they were very frustrated because even the last refuge for a defining element of the distinction between the two had suddenly become ambiguous again. And so they have no clear defining difference between a comet and an asteroid. I don't want to dwell too much on these points, so let me be brief. A traceback of the orbits of comets indicates origin at a common place in the solar system at a common time. 3.2 million years ago for the most recent of these explosion events, which I think is a relatively small body, a moon and not a planet now, even though when I wrote the book, I was thinking it was the most recent planetary explosion. When a planet or a moon explodes, the fragments are going to be so numerous and so dense that the larger fragments will carry away with them debris clouds of all of the smaller fragments that are in their vicinity. When a planet or a moon explodes, the fragments are going to be so numerous and so dense that the larger fragments will carry away with them debris clouds of all of the smaller fragments that are in their vicinity. And so the exploded planet hypothesis predicts that asteroids and comets will be debris clouds and not just isolated single bodies, and therefore they will have satellites consisting of all the fragments of whatever size, big and small, that happened to be close to the object during the explosion and was gravitationally trapped there in orbit around it. In 1991, when I made this prediction formal before the International Astronomical Union, the first time I did this was at a meeting of asteroid, comet, meteorite experts at Flagstaff, Arizona. And the chairman was so skeptical, he challenged me on the floor to a bet that when Gaspra, when the Galileo spacecraft approached Gaspra, the first asteroid it was going to visit, that it would find no satellites. And I said, I will bet any one asteroid could have been the victim of a collision and may or may not, and besides, the low-gain antenna on the spacecraft is malfunctioning. But I said that I will bet that one of the first three asteroids visited will show evidence of satellites. And we made our bet, and the rest is history. The Galileo spacecraft, not at Gaspra because of the low-gain antenna, where they didn't download any of the surrounding space in the pictures around the asteroid to save the antenna time. But in Ida, where they were going to do the same thing, they were not going to download any of the expected empty space around the asteroid in the pictures to save download time. But they just took strips across each image to locate exactly where the asteroid was in the image, and then we're going to just download the asteroid image. But in one of those strips, something else turned up. They're called jail bar strips. And in one of those, another object turned up, and in just that small part of the space that was downloaded, an object, clearly a moon of asteroid Ida, was discovered. And the astronomer at JPL who made the bet conceded it the day after that discovery was made, was announced. They've conceded that I was right about that, but of course all the mainstream astronomers are now trying to find ways to patch the mainstream model that formerly predicted very clearly that satellites orbiting asteroids were dynamically impossible. They now think that it is possible after all, and there are a flock of new models that have just appeared that explain how you can get satellites. They're pretty rare, but you can get them on occasion from unusual circumstances having to do with multiple collision events occurring simultaneously and that sort of thing. As I'll mention a bit later, there's more to the prediction of debris clouds that's going to be tested soon, and I think they're in for another surprise very shortly. The exploded planet hypothesis also predicts that there's a blast wave from the explosion, and this is going to deposit black carbonaceous material on all of the surfaces in the solar system facing the explosion at the time of the blast. And indeed, we do find dark matter all over the solar system, but there are a few cases that are unusually interesting because here's Saturn's satellite Iapetus, and Iapetus is unusual because it has the slowest rotation period by far of any natural moon in the solar system, at taking 3 months to do one spin. So as the blast wave passes over about a two-week period out there in the fairly distant part of the solar system from the explosion,
it still only has a chance to coat Iapetus on one side. So you expect from the exploded planet hypothesis that specifically Iapetus, among all the satellites in the solar system, will be black on one side and white on the other. And that's the way the moon is. It has this black, coal black, 5% reflectivity material on one side, and it has normal icy 50-60% albedo reflectivity on the other side. And that's, again, a mystery to the mainstream astronomers, for which there's a special theory. For the last major explosion event, which I think was Planet V itself, apparently 65 million years ago, I get that date just from the geological evidence on Earth, because on Earth we find lots of geological evidence for exactly what looks like a planetary explosion. And in my 1993 book, before I recognized that there had to be more than one object explode, I pointed this out as a hard conflict of evidence between the exploded planet hypothesis and the data, that the geological evidence said the explosion would have had to have occurred at 65 million years ago, and the astronomical data said 3.2 million years ago. I at that time did not have an explanation, but you'll find a section in Chapter 11 entitled Evidence That Does Not Fit. Well, since then, both of those major lines of evidence that didn't fit then do fit very well with this new idea that there is simply more than one object that exploded. At the KT boundary, the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary on Earth, in the geological record, we have a single, we have actually a dual boundary layer, that is a two-part boundary layer of global extent on the Earth. We have eight. When I made this slide, two more have been discovered since then. There are now 10 known major craters across the globe that date from the same epoch as nearly as we can date them. Not just the Chicxulub crater that gets all the press in the Yucatan, that was the largest of these, but there are craters all over the globe from the same epoch. There are hot zones of radioactivity in the boundary layer at that epoch, especially in Africa. The largest episode of volcanism in the last 100 million years on Earth was on the opposite side of the world from the Yucatan Chicxulub event at the Deccan Traps in India, where there were atmospheric and ocean changes globally at that time. Imagine this one. There is strong evidence in the geological record championed by Ed Anders for a single global fire. And 70% of species, not living organisms, 70% of species perished at the time of this event. And the layer is found everywhere except in Antarctica. And there is some evidence that there is no KT boundary layer in the Antarctic ice or in the Antarctic continent. That would go along with the idea that this is from some kind of global exogenous event, because the Earth's axis is tilted and one of the two poles has to be shielded at all times from the explosion as the debris from the immediate explosion rains onto the Earth. That would produce the boundary layer all over except at one of the two poles, unless you happen to be just at the right time of year when the poles are lined up equally distant from the explosion. So that's the evidence for the explosion of what I call Planet V. The evidence that there had to be more than one such explosion event is that there are similar traumatic events in geological layers at several different epochs. There's evidence for an even stronger event at the Permian-Triassic boundary dating to about 250 million years ago, and I suspect very strongly from the nature of that evidence, from the nature of the predicted nature of the event, that that was the explosion of Planet K, the one in the main asteroid belt. There are also, from meteorite evidence, there are 3 to 4 different distinct meteorite classes suggesting the need for that many different parent bodies of meteorites. Oxygen isotope ratios require at least 2 different parent bodies. There are at least 2 different classes of asteroids that to make up 98% of the asteroid belt. The exposure ages are grouped into several different groups, suggesting dramatic events at several different epochs. The total comet mass is too small to be the result of a planet event, but something about the size of Mars, probably the twin of Mars, would be just about the right size to have been the parent body for the comets and one class of asteroids that are associated with the 3.2 million year ago event. This again predicts that that comets are of the same nature of asteroids, and they're also debris clouds. It's very hard to see satellites of comets even when they come relatively close to Earth, because the bright comas kind of mask everything that's small and has the same brightness per unit area that's hidden in that coma. But here in this Hubble Space Telescope of Hale-Bopp early on, there was a suggestion of something orbiting the primary nucleus. And I'm happy to mention, if you didn't catch the small news note in Astronomy Magazine, and it was a very small news note buried away in a corner, that following our the news note was very in the last couple of months. We made a prediction in 1995, I believe, that when Hale-Bopp drew closer, the Hubble Space Telescope would see evidence for satellites in orbit around its nucleus too. But you could only see them, of course, when it's close enough that the high resolution of the space telescope can penetrate through the coma and see these small objects orbiting close to the nucleus. Unfortunately for us, the safety limitations on the Hubble Space Telescope didn't allow pointing to the telescope, at least this is the official story, didn't allow pointing the telescope at the comet while it was closest to the Earth. In fact, for the year, 6 months before and after the time of closest approach, Hubble did not look at Hale-Bopp at all. And it looked as though the opportunity was going to pass without any chance to discover comets that might be there. Zdeněk Sekanina, a comet expert par excellence and a JPL employee, I'm amazed he still has his position, took some Hubble Space Telescope images as Hale-Bopp was receding and used the most sophisticated computer detection algorithms yet known to investigate the structure of the inner coma, and he found 3 objects that were moving through the background stars with the nucleus of the comet and orbiting the nucleus. And he announced satellites of comet Hale-Bopp in this small news note in Astronomy Magazine. It will be published later this year, and I predict that you will also not see much mention of it in the news at that time. But the predictions still keep coming true, and Hale-Bopp also does have satellites as predicted. Now here's the next one that's going to cause some embarrassment. We have another spacecraft on its way to another asteroid, but this one is different. This is the NEAR, or Near Earth Asteroid Rendezvous mission. Launched in February 96. It's already done a fast flyby of one asteroid, Matilda. I asked my astronomer colleague, friend David Dunham, who's on the team for that, if there was going to have an opportunity to discover asteroids at Matilda, and he said, don't get excited at all. He said, they're adjusting the dynamic range of the camera just to bring out detail on the surface, which will not allow asteroids at their probable brightness to be seen at all. And besides, by the time it gets close enough to see them, the main asteroid will practically fill the field of view, and you won't be able to see out the synchronous orbit where most satellites would be. So he said probably they are not going to see anything on the Matilda flyby. So I made no prediction there. But the asteroid is going on to Eros, and it's not going to fly by Eros. It's going to break and go into orbit and rendezvous and take close-up pictures of everything there is to be seen at asteroid Eros. And so it's going to be our first opportunity to see, if it's true, a debris cloud in orbit around an asteroid. So my formal prediction to the astronomers, and you'll find the challenge on the website, is that they will see not fewer than three moons, a meter or more in diameter, orbiting asteroid Eros. And knowing, I'm attributing motives. No mainstream astronomer has yet accepted my challenge. I think that they're getting a little antsy about the both the publicity it gives to the alternative model and to the track record the model has established. But I'm predicting for all of you, so you can see whether or not the model works, that when the NEAR spacecraft reaches this asteroid in January, settles into an orbit and begins its mapping mission, assuming that it doesn't fly too close and the attempts to get into orbit and smack into something, that it's going to find a whole debris cloud there. And you're going to hear a lot more about what would cause debris clouds around asteroids. Mainstream astronomers don't like to be confronted in this way, and they don't like to be challenged with predictions for alternative models. The result is that we are all left with the dilemma of choosing which expert to believe. In the case of the exploded planet hypothesis, why should you accept? I'm one astronomer among hundreds who are experts in various aspects of the same fields, and very few of them credit even the possibility that what I'm saying is true. One of them has said that if he found evidence that convinced him the exploded planet hypothesis was true, he would go do something else from a living, such as ditch digging, and earn even more money. But this is a kind of an attitude. But really, why should you accept anything I say, given that there are so many experts on the other side? Well, my colleague this morning and friend Richard Hoagland gave an example of you might be impressed if the vice president, Vice Al Gore, got up there and said something. I think the answer is not really in having a higher authority get behind a model. For example, let me read the quote. To get the attention of a large animal, be it an elephant or a bureaucracy, it helps to know what part of it feels pain. Be very sure, though, that you want its full attention. I'll come back in a moment to another quote, which relates to the vice president remark. I got a little bit ahead of myself there, but this one is one that I thought was very apropos of. What challengers from the mainstream model can expect for their own careers, which is a good deal of pain. Going back to Mars and its role with the connection to the exploded planet hypothesis. If Mars is indeed an escape moon, a former moon of Planet V, there had better be plenty of evidence for that. And what is amazing to me is that there is so much evidence, and it is so good, that it is not a more accepted model. In the map you see there, these are contour or elevation maps of features on Mars. Now, what first brought this to my attention was that Mars was unusual in that the center of mass was so far offset by several kilometers from the center of figure. And in other words, Mars is very lopsided. And I wondered about that, and then one of my colleagues mentioned, you know about the crustal dichotomy on Mars? And I said, no, tell me. So I quickly did some research on the crustal dichotomy of Mars, and I found these maps published in the encyclopedia of, what was the name of it, Astronomy and and Space Science Encyclopedia, I think. This one shows the contours on Mars, and it shows the astounding fact, the white being the high elevation areas and the shaded being the low elevation areas, the astounding fact that the southern half or hemisphere of Mars has an elevation that reaches up to 20 kilometers above the what we'll call the sea level, the natural level that something would be at if you flooded all of Mars with water. The northern hemisphere is very flat and all basically at sea level. In fact, it's now been recognized as the flattest solar system, the flattest surface in the solar system. But the southern hemisphere is rugged and high elevation, and there's a sharp boundary between the two. Where in the space of a few kilometers, in the space of perhaps 50 kilometers on the ground, you drop an elevation 3 to 5 kilometers above sea level, from the high terrain to the flat lowlands. The flat lowlands, cratering is very sparse. On the high terrain, cratering is saturated, which means there are so many craters back to back that if you put a new crater down, it destroys old ones underneath. You can't put more craters there than there already are. It's built up 20 kilometers thicker on one side than the other, and the boundary layer is an almost perfect hemispheric line on one side. On the other side, there is some spillover, and I think that's because there were actually two explosion events that Mars was subjected to, one from the explosion of its parent planet, Planet V, 65 million years ago, and the second, the explosion of of the other twin moon, a planet V, Mars's companion, during the interim, and that's the one that gave rise to the comets and or associated asteroids. So I think that the imperfection on one side is due to the second explosion, but the other side is an almost perfect hemispheric boundary. We also know that at that epoch, in addition to the hemispheric dichotomy, that the pole of Mars, we don't know the epoch of it, but the pole of Mars is known to have changed very rapidly. Let's see. Okay, let me go back here. There was a sudden change in the direction of the pole of Mars, and of course, if you smack a planet with a tremendous amount of debris on one side, it's going to become lopsided on that side, but it can't spin with a lopsided mass distribution, so the planet will tip over so that the axis of spin goes through the main mass of the planet. And so you expect a 90-degree shift in the pole direction, and indeed there is geological evidence on Mars that the pole was shifted by 90 degrees from its original position. The Tharsis, the heavy mass accumulated on one side will squeeze the planet and cause an uplift in the newer equatorial region and some volcanism there, and indeed we have the Tharsis volcanoes all in that region. Oops, I didn't mean to go on yet. And that's consistent with the theory. The original dense atmosphere of Mars, for which there's quite a bit of evidence that it was one time even denser than Earth's atmosphere at sea level, is now gone. It has only 1% or less of its original atmosphere. Here's an interesting line of evidence. Xenon-129 excess on Mars. What's special about Xenon-129? It's a fission byproduct that doesn't arise in nature. It requires a massive explosion to get xenon-129. The astronomers know about this being there, but they've speculated that it came from a nearby supernova, a supernova close to the solar system that deposited this. But then it should have deposited equally all over the solar system. Why does Mars show a special excess of xenon-129 compared to normal xenon? I'm going to gloss over this very quickly. This is Alan Hill's 84001, one of the so-called Mars meteorites. I don't think these meteorites are from Mars, despite all the evidence the astronomers cite for that. I think they're from Planet V. And I think that's where the water and the weathering and so on occurred that is on these evidence. The principal reason the astronomers think they came from Mars is because they can prove they didn't come from Earth, and Mars is the only planet around today that could have produced the kind of weathering and erosion seen on these. And also there's some gas bubble evidence I'll mention in a moment. But all of those arguments apply to Planet V, and it's much easier to get your meteorites out of an explosion than it is to eject them from Mars. To eject a meteorite from Mars requires an impact on Mars so strong that the fragments that fly off are going at 5 kilometers a second, 10 times the speed of a bullet. Now, any ordinary matter accelerated in one blast to 10 kilometers a second is vaporized. Anything that is accelerated more than 3 kilometers a second is ordinarily vaporized. So you can't get things off Mars. Sorry, if I'm not sure I said 5. Mars escape velocity is 5. You have to get it up to at least 5. So it's very hard to get things even off the Moon, although that's possible. But off Mars, the escape velocity is just too high to do it. So in order to get these guys off Mars, they have to hypothesize that these are that the original impact event ejected huge objects from Mars, which were mostly vaporized but had cores of at least 12 meters diameter that survived, got off the planet, got into space, and then fragmented further in space to make these small objects, which then eventually hit the Earth. And those are what we collect today. It's much easier to do all this without all these sub-theories, just an exploded planet. This is one of these so-called Mars meteorites, the same one in its discovery environment in Antarctica, where if you find a rock, it has to be from space. This is another one of the so-called Mars meteorites, and this is the one that did the gas bubble analysis. You don't hear much about the fact that the age on this one is billions of years different from the previous one. And the previous one, Allen Hills 8401, is the one where they found evidence of the microfossils. This is the one that produces the gas bubble evidence that associates it with Mars. So we don't even have any evidence associating Allen Hills with Mars like this. And here is the best of the gas bubble evidence of all the elements analyzed. The argon and xenon ratios, and the comparison shows the meteorite, Earth, and Mars. And the figures, if you look down the argon column, the middle column there, 1650 for the meteorite, round numbers, 300 for the Earth, 3,000 for Mars. It's not particularly Mars-like, but it's just, as the astronomers say, the best match we have, and where else could it have come from? The xenon match, also, it's 2 for the meteorite, 1 for Earth, 2.5 for Mars. You'd be hard-pressed to really prove that these things came from Mars with data that is no better than this. Now here's the other quote I mentioned earlier. I was commenting, would a quote from a vice president mean more to you? This quote says, Mars is essentially in the same orbit. Mars is somewhat the same distance from the sun, which is very important. We've seen pictures where there are canals, we believe, and water. If there is water, that means there is oxygen. If oxygen, that means we can breathe. Former Vice President Dan Quayle, August 1989. I'm not so sure that even a quote from a vice president saying the exploded planet hypothesis should be believed is actually something that you should believe. But there is an art to this, and I think it's picking your scientists as people who make sense in what they say, people who stand up to the challenges and answer them with answers that make sense and are not just concocted for the purpose, or invent new hypotheses to explain the failures of the models or new adjustable parameters. And basically, people who make the predictions that scientific method calls for the testing of any hypothesis. That's how the way scientists are trained to distinguish hypotheses. How well they explain the data in terms of simplicity of explanation, minimum number of adjustable parameters, minimum number of hypotheses, and are the predictions of the hypotheses successful? And this is how I think that you too should either judge your hypotheses or pick your experts, according to how well they are faithful to the principles of scientific method. In that spirit, I pay attention to which experts I trust, whose expertise I cannot vouch for myself, but he's a man who does scientific method faithfully and whom I tend to trust. And that's Gilbert Levine, the principal investigator on the Mars Viking lander in 1976. You know that the Viking lander carried three experiments that were supposed to have the possibility of detecting life, but they were just put there to just kind of justify the mission and pro forma, because the scientists were quite sure there was no possibility of their actually detecting life. There were actually four experiments. Three were going to take the sample of soil from Mars and subject it to various tests to look for growth, nourishment, reproduction kind of things, evidence for living organisms in the soil sample. And the fourth experiment would test for organic molecules that they took for granted would be there, because there are organic molecules falling from space all the time in comets and meteorites, so why shouldn't there be organic molecules there? Well, the results from the experiments surprised the scientists, to say the least, because all four experiments came back the opposite of expectations. The three tests for biological activity all came back positive. So why didn't they conclude there was life there? Because the test for organic molecules came back negative, which means it can't be life as we know it, because all life as we know it is carbon-based and based on organics. And therefore, we must be being fooled in the other three experiments. We must be seeing some kind of chemistry emulating life. Maybe this is how life eventually evolves, through chemical processes that just emulate life in the early stages. But that's probably all we're seeing in Mars. Big disappointment. It's not real life. It's just chemistry emulating life. Well, Victor Levine kept at the analysis for 20 years, and he has tested every proposed experiment, every proposed theory that anyone has come up with to date in the laboratory about any way that chemistry can emulate the experimental results from the Viking lander, and they have all failed grossly. There is no way that anyone has yet found to emulate those experimental results through chemistry. But it's not just the absence of being able to emulate the experimental results. He then redid the organic molecules with test using basically a clone of the Viking instrumentation, that was designed to test for organic molecules on Mars. He took it to a sample taken from Antarctica that had known organisms in it, and the organic molecules test also failed from the sample with known organisms in it, because it wasn't sensitive enough. And so he said, that false reading doesn't tell us anything, especially since the microfossils found in the Mars meteorite were smaller than Earth organisms anyway. And so, putting all of this together, the fact that he has redone his own experiment, the labeled release experiment, several times, he is positive that the experiment shows a positive detection of life in the soil sample analyzed, and the arguments why it can't be life have all been disposed of, and you haven't been able to emulate it yet with chemistry. Gilbert Levine now says, the Viking label release experiment detected living organisms in the soil of Mars, period. I'll conclude on that note. since we have another speaker yet this afternoon. We'll continue the story tomorrow, picking up with the Cydonia connection to the exploded planet hypothesis. And those of you interested in more details, and of course there are a lot more details than one can say in a talk, I'll just go back to the there's the book Dark Matter, Missing Planets and New Comets that I published in 93. The website for Meta Research, www.metaresearch.org, and the Meta Research Bulletin. You can find out more details about subscribing to that if you're interested in a quarterly update on all of the exciting developments in the field and how they are can be interpreted both in conventional models and in competing alternatives. Thank you very much.